Love you too.
I'm an addict. My name is Jackie. Good morning, family. First of all, I'd like to thank the Chesapeake Potomac Regional Convention Committee for allowing me another opportunity to serve Narcotics Anonymous. But most of all, especially this beautiful, glorious morning, I'd like to thank Almighty God for giving me a purpose in life. And I'd like to ask if there's anyone else in here who's feeling like me, just grateful to be alive, happy, joyous, and free. I would like to start out by reading something very short, but very powerful from our literature, It Works, How and Why, from the 11th step. We see that regardless of the presence or absence of material success in our lives, we can be content. We can be happy and fulfilled with or without money, with or without a partner, with or without the approval of others. We've begun to see that God's will for us is the ability to live with dignity, to love ourselves and others, to laugh and to find great joy and beauty in our surroundings. Our most heartfelt longings and dreams for our lives are coming true. These priceless gifts are no longer beyond our reach. They are, in fact, the very essence of God's will for us. That's a particularly favorite part of mine from It Works, How and Why. I think a very powerful statement, because the person that you see that stands up here before you today is simply an addict, a human being, very fallible, still full of character defects. The person that you see standing up here is just like you, and I consider myself a true miracle. I read that part because I need to always keep in focus where I came from and who I am today. I don't want to be a power of example. I want to be an example of the power of God's work in another human being. I want so very much to live like I say I live. I want so very much to be the person that I want to be, that I know God wants me to be. And I want so very much, especially when I stand up here, to be walking the walk and not just talking the talk. I'd like to do something just a little different very briefly this morning. I would really like to dedicate this message to a young lady that God brought into my life several years ago in Narcotics Anonymous, and her name very appropriately was Hope. I've never done this before. I feel like part of the purpose of people who become Narcotics Anonymous speakers is to speak the feelings in the heart and the recovery and the hopes and dreams of others who are no longer here. And I didn't find out that Hope had died until I got here to this convention today. Hope was a 24-year-old addict who died of the virus, who came into my life about 3 years ago. She called me up one day when I was going through one of those ego experiences in Narcotics Anonymous, one of those intellectual questioning my purpose with God. I had been to speak at a workshop out in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. When I went up to get a copy of my tape afterwards, they told me I had to pay for it. I didn't think that that was real spiritual, and what I told them at that point was, I came to buy other people's tapes, and I don't know how spiritual this is going to sound, and I really don't give a damn, but I don't think I should have to buy my own tape. That if you can make money off of me coming this far to carry a message of hope and a promise of freedom, then you can at least give me my tape free. And of course I went home and I struggled with this addict mentality, this, I think I'm going to get an attorney, I think that I should be copyrighted. That from now on when I speak, maybe I should even get dividends from the tape. But to keep it spiritual, all the profits I'll give to like rehabs and recovering addicts. Now, you know that wouldn't have happened, but that's how I try to convince myself. And I was going through this dilemma, and of course it became a mission and an obsession, so I not only stayed at home and talked to myself about it, I called up my other friends on the NA circuit who were NA speakers. And I said, now what do you think about this? And I got a little support, but a little fear. People, well, I don't know, and maybe they won't ask me to speak anymore. And what I did was I decided to pray about it. And in a very short span of time, I got a phone call from a young lady that I didn't know. I had never remembered meeting. And what she told me was, she said, my name is Hope. And she said, someone gave me one of your tapes. She said, my sponsor gave me your number and told me to call you. She said, I'm in the last stages of the virus. I have seizures repeatedly. I have to be hospitalized a lot. I have tumors in my brain. I asked her, how old are you? She said, 24 years old. And the first thought that came to me is like, why me, God? Why are you having her call me? I don't have the virus that I know of, so why me? And whenever I feel confronted with that dilemma, like I have to be still and maybe not know the answer, not be able to fix something, I know that I needed to pray. And I just prayed and asked God to allow me to listen because I knew He would reveal to me. And what she told me was, she said, I was on pain medications for a long time, and now they're telling me that I have to stop taking these medications so I can take other drugs that may help to prolong my life, and I want to do that. She said, I'm in acute withdrawal. I'm in a great deal of pain. And in my area, when I have convulsions, there's people there that tell me, when I have seizures, there's people there that tell me I need to leave the meeting and go in the bathroom by myself to have a seizure. There's people in my area that don't understand about these drugs. And I knew then why God had put my phone number in her path. She said, I remembered you sharing about the last time you were in detox, that you were detoxing from a 13-year methadone habit, a dope habit, a cocaine habit, everything that somebody could use. And you got through the pain because whether you died or not, you wanted to die clean. She said, and I had to find out, how did you get through that? And we talked for a long time. And we built a relationship over these last few years. She'd come to my house to visit me, and one time when she came to visit me, she had so many seizures that I got afraid, and I called an ambulance, and we had to take her to the hospital. The last time I saw her was at the World Convention in Baltimore, and I'm grateful that we took pictures, because I have a picture of her and myself on my mantle at home, and I just wanted her to know that I love her, even though she's not with us anymore. It's very important that I read this part of the 11th step because it lets me know that God truly works. It lets me know that God works through Narcotics Anonymous. It lets me know that God works through this step process. I was 15 years old the first time I picked up a chemical that just happened to be alcohol. I was 37 years old before I could put it down. On May 2nd, 1986, I found myself at home in a great deal of physical pain. I had been forced to go to Narcotics Anonymous meetings by a methadone counselor who loved me more than I could possibly love myself. She was tired of watching me kill myself, and she gave me an ultimatum, and it wasn't to stop using. The ultimatum was that I needed to go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, or she was throwing me off the clinic that I was on. Now, that may not sound like a big deal, but I had been thrown off of just about every program in North Philadelphia. I was an entitled addict. I was a veteran of the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War, and it meant I could go in and out of VA facilities like a revolving door. I was usually the only female, so I felt very entitled, very unique, very special, very privileged, and I talked to people like they were dirt. I talked to people like they owed me something. I talked to people who were trying to help me like I talked to people in the street, kind of like a death wish, wanting somebody to hurt me, to punish me for the person I had become. I'm not that person today. Today I've learned in Narcotics Anonymous how to respect others and how to respect myself, how to hold myself up with dignity, not false pride, how to tell somebody that I'm hurting, how to tell somebody still that at almost 10 years clean, I have obsessive thoughts sometimes that will drive me up a wall. How even in recovery, sometimes I'm afraid to come into Narcotics Anonymous meetings and tell people what I'm going through and what I'm feeling. Most of the growth that I've had in recovery has been through my relationships or my inability to have relationships with other people. And when I first came around, and even for years afterwards, there would always seem to be somebody in the meeting who, especially when I was there, would make some comment that this is not a Relationships Anonymous meeting. And then other people who were newer than them would feel very intimidated, and they wouldn't share the dilemmas. They wouldn't share the trials and tribulations, but they also wouldn't share the growth either. There were people in there who were in a lot of pain and were suffering. And somehow God gave me the courage and the strength and lifted me up beyond my need for approval from these people to just share about what was happening with me and my relationships with other people. And consequently, I believe God rewarded me with the opportunity and the gift to go a lot of places in Narcotics Anonymous to share with other people the trials and tribulations and the growth and the blessings that I've gotten through my interactions, my learning how to have relationships relationships with other people in recovery and outside of recovery. I'm real grateful for this gift and this opportunity. I pray every day that God continues to use me in this way, but I know that He uses a lot of us for a certain period of time for a certain reason. It's our responsibility to find out what our gifts and talents are and to cultivate them and use them to help other addicts. It is not our job to come in here and to use another recovering addict. It's not our job to come in here and harm someone else in our family. And I can say that today because I'm the person who harmed a lot of people. I'm the person who was harmed by brothers and sisters in recovery. I'm the person who had to learn from being hit in the head and drugged down the streets of recovery. I'm not the person who came in here and said, good, this looks like the best way I want to go, so I'm going. On May 2nd, 1986, I found myself on my knees in my house with a very strong desire to stop using. I had been going to meetings for about 6 months using, forced to go, and see, I'm saying forced to go, but you have to understand, this woman didn't have anybody following me around to make sure I went. She didn't give me a piece of paper to get signed to prove that I went. Somehow I just felt if I didn't, she was going to know. But today I understand. Today I understand with hindsight, which is 20/20, and with the spiritual connection that I have with a power greater than myself, that God is the one that intervened divinely through this individual, this human being, to get me to where He wanted me to be. I understand that today. But at the time I was angry. And I went to meetings, and I used before I go to meetings and still raise my hand and share because I thought I had something so profound to say. I went to meetings with paraphernalia on my body or on my pocketbook. I never made it there with any drugs, but I made it there with a lot of stuff that I wasn't supposed to make it there with. If it wasn't for shame, I would have taken money out of the basket because I wouldn't put money in the basket. I just felt like the people that were sitting up here were taking the money and had found some manipulative way to dopamine using. Free money. Come show up, tell a bunch of other addicts how they're staying clean, take the money and use. I really believed that. But that was the depth of my hopelessness. I did not believe that there was anything, any way, that I could stop using. I surrendered to the fact that I was going to die a hopeless dope fiend in a shooting gallery somewhere, having said the wrong thing to the wrong person at the wrong time, and either I was going to die of an OD or somebody was going to blow my mouth off my face. Because my greatest character defect all that time and for a great period of time in recovery was my mouth, was my inability to stop and think first before I opened it. I believe today, as a result of the experiences that I got even in those months using, that it doesn't matter why you come. It doesn't matter why you're here. It only matters that you're here. Something's going to happen. It doesn't matter why you're here. And this woman knew this. She was not in recovery, but she had seen us come in and come out different people. She had seen people go in that were hopeless and come out with hope. She had seen people like me who had started off as children with goals and dreams and hopes and become hopeless, hope to die, drug addicts, feeling like there was no way out. I felt like I had tried to find every way out that there was. I used for at least the last five years, even when I didn't want to use anymore. And when I came in here and I listened to people talk about other people who had relapsed and they said things like, they use because they want to use, I knew inside that that wasn't necessarily true. I came to learn and appreciate and respect the power of this disease that I have. That even in recovery, it has taken me to places that I didn't want to go. Because of the denial, because of the intellect, because of the intelligence that this addict had. This up here between my ears is the thing that in 1971 in my first rehab told me was the thing that was probably going to kill me. Because I always felt like I could find a way out. I always felt if you just give me a moment, whether you give me the right book, something to read, just give me a moment to figure this out, some strategy, some plan, I can find a way out of this situation. And it took 22 years of using to finally surrender and say, I don't have a clue. I really believe that this is going to kill me. I'm the addict who would sit on the bathtub with a spike in my arm and take my pulse in the other hand, feeling like I could measure that in between, that on the edge state where it would be just good enough, but not enough to kill me. And when I would wake up in ambulances or find myself with projectile vomiting when I changed drugs of choice and I would overamp and go into convulsions, I still felt like I wasn't becoming to the point of surrender. It's just that I hadn't found a way yet. I needed to be able to find the right way to measure it. Because you see, bottom line was I could not imagine myself living without drugs. I didn't even have a clue or understanding that I didn't know how to live, period. I couldn't understand how this became me in the first place. This was not supposed to be me. I'm not supposed to be standing up here in a room full of several hundred addicts, drug addicts. I was supposed to be the attorney. I was supposed to be the person with a PhD. I was supposed to be the movie star that I always wanted to be as a kid, an actress. At the end of my using, I could have won many Oscars. Many of you. I had become somebody that my family didn't recognize. I had become somebody that I loathed. But I moved so fast all the time, I never stood still long enough to even appreciate how much I hated myself. I think, you know, when I say this all the time, when I came in here, if you had asked me even then, at 37 years old, 22 years of using, no place left in my body to shoot dope, if you had asked me why, I still couldn't have told you. I would have had a lot of, like, therapeutic stuff, like my father was an addict, and I grew up in a dysfunctional family, but I couldn't tell you what I was running from or what I was running to. All I knew how to do was run. That's all I knew how to do. I didn't know what the answer was. I didn't know what the destination, I didn't know what the fear consisted of. All I knew how to do was run. My greatest strength in my addiction was that I learned how to look at me from outside and just really accept how I look to other people. You know, I knew what I looked like. I looked like somebody who was supposed to be used and victimized. I was female. I was Caucasian. I was little. All I wanted to do was talk a lot. I was needy. You know, this is somebody who's supposed to be used and victimized. And the way that I learned how to survive was I could walk into a room and I could feel you. And I could feel what you were planning on doing to me before you had the whole plan formulated. And I would get what I came for and I would be gone. The only fact of the matter is that all I did was run. Just run and run and run. And any time that I was forced to stay still was not by my own decision or my own doing. God was even doing for me what I couldn't do for me then. Every time I was incarcerated, every time I was hospitalized, every time I ended up in another rehab, time and time again, He was trying to pull me back. He was trying to pull me back. He wanted me to do something else, and I couldn't see it. The fear that I lived in was, I can't live without these drugs. I live to use, and I use to live, and that's what the vicious cycle was for me. Every time I would go into treatment and the drugs would be out of my system for a short period of time, the same thing would happen over and over and over. The feelings of guilt, all the memories, all the people I had used, my family, the tears in my mother's eyes, all the hurt, all the harm, all the degradation, things, the I nevers that were like long gone, they were old. You know, there's something interesting about doing an I never for the first time. It's not hard after then. It's not hard to be around people and learn new I nevers. I became something that my family didn't even recognize, and all I wanted was out. That's all I ever wanted was out. I couldn't believe that I was the person that I was becoming. And I think because of that, I really thought for many years that when I'm really ready, I can stop. I didn't understand the power of this disease. I didn't understand my powerlessness over it, that once I picked it up, I couldn't stop. So consequently, every time I would get out of these institutions, the pain, the shame, the humiliation was so deep. The only way I knew how to take the pain away for a moment was to use again. And then I would have to do deeper things, worse things, more perverted things, things that I thought I would take to my grave before I would tell another person, things that really were the reason why by the time I got here, I no longer believed in God. I was so full of shame that I really believed that as long as I didn't believe in Him, He wasn't looking down and watching me at what I was doing. I had no real concept of who God is. I had no concept that God is simply love. And love is manifested from inside. I didn't have the ability to love anymore. I didn't have the ability to trust or respect anymore. Not you, not me. So I didn't have God in my life. Every call that I came, every close call that I got out of, whether it was another person that rescued me, whether it was an authority figure that locked me up or gave me some ultimatum or some sentence to do some time, every single time I really felt like it was me that got myself out of that situation. Well, on May 2nd, 1986, I had finally, after coming to Narcotics Anonymous meetings for 6 months, had stopped using everything except the methadone for the last 3 months. And the reason that I stopped using everything wasn't because I really wanted to. It was the experience that now gives me the experience to tell you that even God uses our character defects to get His will done. And one of my greatest character defects was my pride and my ego and my arrogance and my self-righteousness. That's four of them, isn't it? I wanted to be the one sitting on this side of the desk. I really even then felt like, now you know what, I'm going to tell you the truth. All those years I was using, somehow there would always be little moments that this is not supposed to be the way you're going to go out, Jackie. You're not supposed to go out this way. This isn't supposed to be you. There's something else that you're supposed to do. And 3 months into coming to meetings, I decided that I wanted to be up here. And the only way I could be, well, not up here, but on the other side of the desk at meetings. So I stopped using everything. I stopped using everything, and then what I did was I would go to meetings and sit behind this man that I had lusted after in the street, but my self-esteem had never given me the courage to say anything because he was very handsome and he sold dope and he had a lot of power and a lot of women around him and one of those things. You know, and I was just a street whore, you know, and I never had the courage to say anything to him. And he was in meetings. And it took him longer to find a vein than it could ever take me. And he was in Narcotics Anonymous meetings clean 3 months when I got there. And I would sit behind him and I would fantasize. And I would go to the dances and try to look cute and try to put myself, like, somewhere where he would see me. You know? And today, like, when I look around the rooms and I see women that come in, I can tell who newcomers are, women and men. I can tell. I can tell by how you dress, and I can tell by how you carry yourself, and you know what? I don't judge you because I've been there. And when I say that I don't care why you're here, I really mean that from my heart. Because sitting behind him in meetings, hoping I would get some attention to validate me, to let me know that I was still attractive, that I was worth something, even if it was just for outside stuff, was the reason that it kept me going back. So whatever your reason is, just keep coming back. Oh, and I said horrendous things. I said things that, like, embarrassed me today, you know. I remember hugging him one time and actually sticking my tongue in his ear and saying to him, I'll take you someplace you've never been before. And thank God. See, this was my first experience with letting me see that Narcotics Anonymous didn't just work for women who I thought were the only spiritual creatures on earth, but for men. Because he looked at me and he said, well, Jackie, it must be to the moon because that's the only place I've never been. And he didn't use me and he didn't take advantage of me and I felt rejected and I left the meeting and I used. But I kept coming back to meeting. And I got about 3 months not using anything else except the methadone and they asked me to share at a meeting. And I had been collecting keychains, and I ran back to my counselor, and I said, you know, they asked me to speak at this NA meeting, and she said, but you can't. And I said, what do you mean I can't? And she said, well, you're not clean. I said, my urines are all clean. You know, I haven't used in 3 months. And she said, you're still drinking methadone, Jackie. I said, that's not a drug. That's like plasma. That's blood, you know, and it's legal. You give it to me. She said, Narcotics Anonymous is about complete abstinence. It's about not using any mood or mind-altering chemical. And real quickly, I will qualify that with, there is nobody in here that's qualified to diagnose or undiagnose, prescribe or unprescribe for any other addict in this room. So, you know, I've had people so many times, the places that I go, once in a while, not too much anymore, somebody will come up and say, well, you know, we're not supposed to share about specific drugs. This is my experience. And I've just had too many people come up to me after meetings to tell me that they're on methadone maintenance programs. Are they recovering? Can they come to meetings? Can they do this? Can they do that? You better get your ass in here. I don't care what you're using. Just get in here. Just get in here because the hope is going to come. May 2nd, 1986, I made a decision, probably about the end of April, I made a decision that I really wanted to speak at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. I really wanted to be part of this. So I made a decision that I was going to go home and I was going to stop on my own. And I had managed through that process of that 3 months that I wasn't using other drugs to get down to 20 milligrams. And anybody that's ever happened to use that particular chemical knows that it's no joke. You know, it is no joke, man. I mean, I was never that sick in my life. And 2 days later, I found myself on the floor of my living room not being able to make it upstairs. And I made a promise to myself right then that even if I didn't make it through, even if I died before that night was over, I was not going to use. I wanted this so badly for the first time in my life. See, and I got that desire from the hope. I got that desire from coming in here and seeing other people that I had used with that I thought were dead. I mean, that I knew were worse than me. You know, I mean, they probably thought the same thing about me. You know, all they thought about me, most of them didn't even know I had a name. You know, my whole identity was I was Sam from 20th and York's Woman, the little white girl that drove a blue Regal with two big black Dobermans in the car. You know, that was my whole identity. That was the piece I really wasn't ready to give up that easily. I wasn't ready to give him up. I certainly wasn't going to give the dogs up, and God bless me to keep them all the whole time in my recovery. But all I knew was that night, something different was going to happen in my life. And I called down to the bar where he was selling dope at, and I asked him to come home. I asked him to come home, and he told me, he said, I'll be there. I don't know what I can do, but I'll be there. And by the time he got home, I was in a great deal of pain. And he went upstairs to run hot water in the tub, and I found myself just sitting on the floor and just rocking myself and just rocking. And I was crying, but tears wouldn't come. I was so dehydrated, tears wouldn't even come. I had never remembered hurting that badly. And the experience that I had that night, I really have to preempt with this, that I have a God of my understanding. I am entitled to have a God of my understanding. You have the absolute right, and I pray that you find the God of your understanding in these rooms. I pray that you really come to believe that you have that right. For many of us, we've been raised up with a God of someone else's understanding. And we really believe that if we deter from that or find something different that really meets our needs, that we know is loving and caring, we feel like we betray these people who have raised us up and taught us about God. It took me 2 years in here to really go on a journey to find out who God was for me. I came out with a God that had the same name that my parents had raised me about, but he was not the God they had taught me about. But on this particular night, I had this experience, and I had to say all that first to share this with you. The only experience I'd ever had with God really was what my family had taught me, and the only vision I had of who God was, the only face I had ever seen, was God on TV at Christmas and Easter. And right then at that moment, the God that I now have in my life, who I believe is the God that works for me, was still working in me even though I didn't know who he was. And he allowed me to see this picture, a familiar face, so to speak. And what I saw was a man, a human being, walking, carrying a cross, and people were throwing things at him and calling him names. And he was crying, and it wasn't for himself. It was for these people that he loved so much. This was all I'd ever seen of who God was. And I knew right then that what he was showing was the most unconditional love that anyone has ever showed anyone else. That even if I came to believe right that moment that even if in this world, in our culture, in our society, we were to find out at some point that the story of this man were to turn out to be the biggest farce, the biggest hoax that there ever was, all I knew was that this was a human being who believed that he was here for a purpose and who loved us enough and who loved me enough that he was willing to suffer for somebody else's wrongdoings. And right that moment, what I asked him was, God, please just don't take away this pain. I'm not asking you to take away the pain. every time the pain has been removed, I've forgotten the pain. And every time I've forgotten the pain, I've ended back in the same situation time and time again. And that's the first time that I heard a voice inside tell me. I didn't hallucinate and hear something coming from the wall. I heard a voice inside that told me, I've already done this for you. You don't have to do this anymore. I have something else planned for you. At 2 years clean, I went on a journey because I had become involved with a man who had a different faith than I did. Well, I can't even say that. He had a different religion than I did. I didn't really have a faith. I didn't belong to anything particular. I thanked God every day. I thought I had a relationship with God. And I began to have a lot of questions and a lot of doubts. And I went to ministers from both faiths, and they both told me the same thing, and I'll share this with you. They said, Jackie, God does not want you to believe blindly. See, I had been taught that faith was blind.